Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, your tour guide into the geographies of everything and nothing. Coming to you from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria, this is Episode 1, Keyword, Geographical Imagination. In tonight's episode, we will talk with Professor Emeritus of Geography from the Open University, Doreen Massey, Professor of Geography at Royal Holloway, University of London, Veronica Della Dora, and Dr. Jesse Gilley from the University of Kansas, about the geographical imagination. They'll help us define what this is and how it's formed. So welcome to the show. Tonight is our very first episode, and we're excited to be here. We have a lot in store for you. I want to accomplish a few things tonight. One is to describe what this program is about, and with the help of the geographers I mentioned, these geographers working in the field, define what a geographical imagination is. And I think this will help us get set up for future episodes and discussions to have a little bit of a theoretical framing before we embark on this expedition. We've called this first episode, Keyword Geographical Imagination, because we want to define what this keyword means to geographers and non-geographers alike. My name's Kevin S. Fox. I'm a cultural geographer from the United States. I'm talking to you, though, from Salzburg, Austria, from Radio Fabrique, a community radio station based here that opens its doors to a wide variety of radio show concepts. I proposed the idea to them about, let's say, 6 or 8 weeks ago, and then have been developing this with them through some trainings. And because they're open to these different concepts, I just have to say that they're open to a wide variety of voices and thus a wide variety of ways of seeing the world, which I think is just right for our program. Our program is really about ways of seeing the world. It's about how geography and space inform the way we think of the world and how that way we think of the world perhaps is geographical or spatial. So that's the main theme of this show. I think with the help of our guests tonight, we'll be able to outline that quite a bit more. I also wanted to say that I see this as a public geography project. For those of you listening, for us at the show, this does two things. One, it takes the voices of academic geographers and brings them to a different kind of public, one outside the all too intimate spaces of the academic conference and the all too expensive pages of academic publishing. And we invite them here in conversation, in dialogue, to talk about some of their work, but also to engage with a wider public. And it's not only the academic geographers too, it's practitioners, artists, just different people thinking about space to bring them to a wider audience. I guess that's the part of the other part is we want to engage with the widest variety of voices, just like Radio Fabrique, and have kind of our motto is that everyone is a geographer and everyone is able to analyze the spaces and places in which they navigate and operate in and live in. And so in bringing these multiple voices and hopefully multiple texts as well, we here on this show want to continue to produce geographies of everything and nothing. Well, as this show is a show of dialogue between different voices and text, I want to start here with what I'll call Fragment 1. It comes from Professor Veronica Della Dora, who teaches and researches at the Royal Holloway, the University of London. Let's listen to what she has to say about the geographical imagination.
The geographic imagination, I guess, in its most literal sense, is our ability to produce mental images of places especially of places we don't have direct experience of, places we have no physical access to. For example, I've never been to Afghanistan, but in my mind, this word triggers images of barren mountains and scenes of war that I might have seen on TV or that I might have read about. The geographical imagination is also, I think, our ability to picture in our mind what our eyes can't grasp in its entirety. For example, we can't see the earth in its totality, we can't see our country in its totality, we can't even see our city in its totality. And yet, we can picture them in our mind thanks to maps, to satellite images or aerial photographs. The geographical imagination to me is a bit like a horizon. It is a meeting point between here and there, between the present and the future, between fact and fiction. It is perhaps the point where all these categories blur into each other. The geographical imagination to me is a process. It is a way of knowing the world and making sense of the world. It is a way of encompassing both the known and the unknown. It is, if you want, a form of desire. It is that very thing in our mind that makes us push the frontiers of our knowledge of the world. And here I think, for example, of the great voyages of discovery driven, as it were, by images of Edenic islands and beautiful promised lands set beyond the horizon. I'm also thinking of an interview with Reinhold Messner I've recently come across, in which he says that he has always climbed with his imagination, first of all. His mind has always been a step ahead of his abilities and physical strengths. In this way, he kept climbing steeper and steeper walls until none of them eventually appeared impossible to him. His first excursion as a little boy, he says, deeply shattered him, not because it was long and weary and difficult, but because it allowed him to see beyond his valley for the first time. From the mountaintop, he saw another valley, and then another one. And further in the distance, he saw other mountains. Only beyond those mountains, he saw no more valleys, no more mountains, nothing. And then the world suddenly became bigger. The cosmos suddenly enlarged. It was at that point that his curiosity was awakened. What is beyond those mountains? This is the question, he says, that has always remained in the background of my life.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. Tonight, this is episode 1, keyword geographical imagination. For more information about the show, check us out on the web at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Let's get back to the show. Over the phone, we have Professor Doreen Massey. We are excited at the show to have as our very first interview guest one of the world's most foremost thinkers, geographical thinkers, whose contributions include key texts such as Space, Place, and Gender, For Space, and World City, whose ideas about the global sense of place and power geometries have added to key discussions in the field and the discipline of geography in the last 40 years. She joins us from outside of London. This is Professor Emeritus of Geography from the Open University. Thank you for coming, Doreen.
Hello, thank you.
Yes. The first question, really, I guess I'd like to get into is, what do we refer to, what is meant by a geographical imagination?
It's the kind of implicit imagination of the world that we carry around with us, mental images of the world we live in. It can be all kinds of things and at all scales. I mean, it might just be about the other end of the road being the bad end of the road. It could be an image of another country. It could be something much more wide-ranging. But it's a kind of implicit picture of how we think about the world. And it can occur in all kinds of situations. And I want to argue that it's very important that we examine those, the pictures that we do carry with us about the world that we live in, because they have effects upon the way in which we act.
Right. And what are the kinds of things, do you think, inform that geographical imagination? You're saying sort of pictures. So I'm hearing there's this imagery that comes to mind.
And that's right.
What are those things that you think kind of inform that imagination?
Loads of things. So the way in which we talk on a day-to-day basis, images in the media, political discussions. Let me give an example. We, including myself, we often kind of think implicitly that local people should have rights over their own local places. And we refer to local people and local community. And there's an aura of kind of positivity around it. And behind that imagination, behind that kind of position, there's an implicit imagination of a world which is divided up into particular places where local people live settled lives and have rights over that space. On the other hand, quite a lot of us, at the same time as having that image, also have an image of the planet. I mean, ever since we went up into space and looked back and saw the planet, there's been this very powerful image of a planet which belongs to all of us. In other words, a planet that shouldn't have boundaries, where we should be able to move everywhere. And I think, and in that case, that's a very different image, a very different geographical imagination of the world than the one that sees it as divided up between local people with rights over their own places. And I think one of the most important things to say about geographical imaginations is not only do we all have them and use them all the time, but they're often quite contradictory, that we can hold both of those imaginations at the same time. So, for instance, people on what we might call the right of the political spectrum, the more conservative end of the political spectrum, often argue in favor of free trade, the free movement of capital and of corporations and of trade around the borders. And in arguing for that, they often point to a world, they say, which should be a world without borders. And yet the same people, the same conservative people, will often argue against immigration into their own countries and say, but we need strong protective borders to preserve the culture and the rights and the contributions of the people that live here. And in that way, they often bring in as justification for this an imagination of a world divided up into regions and places where people have rights over that area.
Right. So please continue.
What's wrong is, I mean, people can very well hold both of those positions. What's wrong is using an imagination of the world to support that statement and claiming that that imagination is a universal truth about the world. So if you argue in favor of free trade and say we've got to go for a world without borders, then you have to say the same thing about migration. And I think one of the big contributions that my discipline, geography, can make is to be more rigorous about these geographical imaginations, to dig down beneath the political rhetoric and to say, this is the kind of world that you're imagining when you make this statement, but it doesn't apply to this other statement. And so we can make explicit the geographies that lie behind some of the arguments that we all get engaged in on a day-to-day basis in politics and in society more generally, and try to think, what are the real issues that we're talking about here? It's not that the world is always divided up or it will be without borders. It is a deeper political issue that's in question. So, for instance, if instead of talking about the right, we talk about more progressive people, and I would put myself there, and I admit to occasionally having contradictory imaginations about this. Progressive people will be, for instance, in favor of local people in the Amazon, defending their local areas against loggers and against ranchers and against people who are coming into the Amazon forest. But at the same time, we are likely to be much more sympathetic to migrants coming into our own countries. And both of those positions are perfectly okay as long as we don't have resort to justifying them by a geographical imagination that we say is a universal one. What we're doing then as leftists is to say, actually, it isn't that no borders is good, and it isn't that local places are good. What we're talking about here is a battle between the powerless and the poor and the rich and the powerful. So we defend the Amazonian people not because there's a universal right to local places, but because they're powerless and poor. And we think about the problems that migrants have in coming to our own countries, not because we have an image of a world without borders, but because they are often desperately poor people from, say, the global south. So it's a way of being a lot more strict about the kinds of statements we make about geography.
Right. And you're talking about this Amazon example. It immediately makes me think of kind of the imbalance of power and sort of in thinking about this geographical imagination and maybe connecting it to your concept you've introduced, certainly in a lot of your writing, to geographers of the spatial geometries.
Of power geometries,
yeah,
yes.
Power geometries.
That's right. I mean, one of the big things that geography has to teach us is about our interdependence across the globe, within a country, within a place, and across the globe. It's about the coexistence of other peoples and other cultures all at the same time. And in that sense, geography and space poses to us the question of how we're going to live together. But I think sometimes there can be a kind of evocation of interdependence in a rather romantic, sentimental way. Oh, we're all linked up, aren't we? And yes, we are. But those links are all full of power, and we're all placed in different positions, if you like, within those power geometries. Those geometries that link us together are the geometries of finance capital. They may be the geometries of intricate battles within neighborhoods. They may be, for instance, in London, the city in which I'm speaking to you from now, there's a huge variation in power between the people that work in the financial center in the city of London and the people around that city who at the moment cannot find the money to be able to buy housing because property prices are going through the roof. So we all live embedded in this space which is structured by power relations. And that's what I was trying to get at with power geometries.
Right.
And that does bring us back to geographical imagination, because it's about always thinking of ourselves, both personally, but also, as you said, collectively, as people in a place, as located in a wider world and having a responsibility towards that. And right. That imagination, I refer to it as an outward lookingness, a consciousness that always, as we live our lives, there's an out there of people we are inevitably connected with, on whom we depend, and on whom we have effects. And that is very much a geographical imagination.
This is Geographical Imaginations. Brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. Check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Let's get back to the episode and fragment number two, Jesse Gilley from the University of Kansas.
There are many ways to define geographical imagination, but the way that I like to think about it is considering the importance of places and the relationships between our places and other places. For example, some people have a preference for city life. They like the big buildings, or they like the history. And other people, as we're all aware, like to live in the country in more rural settings. And things that are expressed in this way are, you know, community life and knowing your neighbors, for example. Well, those are based on geographical imaginations about which is better. Some people who dislike the city think of it as being evil or, you know, being full of crime. And a lot of scholars would tell you that this definition or this image that people have of inner cities, as it's often known, is a creation because cities are very different. But there's a strong geographical imagination about the inner city. So there's views of in the suburbs of this flow of people or this flow of drugs coming out. So let's think of it in a larger scale in terms of countries. Right now there's a big debate between people about Mexico. Some people think that the people coming from Mexico don't belong here. Well, that's based on a geographical imagination of what our country is like and who should be here and who should not be here.
Imagine a different geography with your geographical imagination. Now let's return to Doreen Massey. I think it's important for us then to consider that this geographical imagination is something produced, something created, something we are actively engaged in. And so it begs the question then, what is a fuller geographic imagination?
Well, for me, it would be an understanding of the simultaneity of all the different lives and cultures that are going on at any one moment. So space, in that sense, would be a cut through all the different societies and lives and things, human and non-human, that are going on at the same time. Kind of an ability to live life in a consciousness of that multiple complexity, that complexity of all the things happening at the same time.
Would you easily sort of use the term spatial consciousness when you described the geographical imagination, or do you see that as something a bit different, or is that kind of the same thing?
I don't mind about the term. I mean, yes, to be conscious of that is fine. Yes, I'm not committed to a particular terminology.
Right.
I'm committed to a kind of outward lookingness of the imagination.
Right. So to continue with this same idea of, can we and how do we expand this geographical imagination, I bring back Veronica Della Dora in fragment number 3.
Well, I think in a sense we're always unconsciously expanding our geographical imagination. When we read a novel, when we watch a movie, when we read the newspaper, when we listen to a song from a distant country, when we bump into a travel advert at the metro station, we're always adding new images to our geographical storehouse. We're always unwillingly and unconsciously creating or adjusting geographical images in our mind. I would say, though, that our geographical imagination about a specific country or region and our cartographic literacy expand, especially at times of conflict, perhaps. For example, before 9/11 and the war against terror, a large part of the American population was unable to point at Afghanistan on a map. And yet, within matter of days, most Americans could not only point at Afghanistan on the world map, but would also associate the country with a whole range of images. And of course, we could say the same about Iraq or Ukraine. One might wonder about the accuracy of those images. I guess the point here is not really accuracy. The point is their effect. Which sort of geographies do they produce in our minds? How do they shape our ideas of other cultures? And most importantly, how do they shape our relationships with others? The geographical imagination is not simply an abstraction. It is a realm of thoughts. It is a contested domain. It is something that does have a very real impact on the world and on our everyday lives. And I guess, we like it or not, our geographical imagination is always expanding, and often in ways that are beyond our consciousness, and perhaps also beyond our control.
So it is in that contested space, that contested domain that Veronica Della Dora talks to us about, that this show really wants to explore. It wants to interrogate, to prod, to uncover. It's how we imagine our world, from the scale of your body to the globe, from your neighborhood to your continent. It's asking ourselves how we imagine ourselves in this world as individuals, as communities, as nations. What are the different ways of seeing that we can kind of explore and talk about? That's the trajectory of this show. That's where we want to go, not only today, but for the course of the next episodes, that we ask ourselves that question is how do we picture the way in which we inhabit the world. So let's go back to, Doreen Massey and ask her about how, you know, what is one of the dominant ways that we picture the world today? And what's the dominant way of seeing the world?
I think geographical imaginations are formed through a whole variety of ways. As you say, the pictures that we receive constantly through the media, political discourses, daily life, all kinds of ways in which those imaginations are formed. I think there's one very strong one at the moment that is around, which is that we live, don't we, everybody says, in a digital age. This is the age of the social media. This is the age of finance. Everything is virtual. It's flowing around the world freely without borders. And it is somehow immaterial. There's almost an imagination of a digital world which is kind of up there somewhere in the ether. And actually, there's a lot of truth in the sense that there is a whole new technology and means of communication. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there are still borders, and there are digital borders. As we know, there are people who have access and people who don't have access. And the very production of the digital world involves a search for rare metals. It involves huge complexes of very physical production. It involves cables. It involves electronics. It involves masses and masses of energy and huge demands upon the planet. And that often gets forgotten in that new geographical imagination, which is that we can all surf around without touching the ground. So there are constantly new ones are being produced, and I think that's one of the newest ones. And once again, perhaps our role as thinkers, and especially as geographical thinkers, is to say, hey, wait a minute, I'm not simply denying what you say, but remember the roots of this digital world in the haves and the have-nots, and in the physical production and the necessity for the metals and the people that have to mine those metals and the communities that are disrupted by that. This isn't a purely immaterial, ethereal, virtual world.
So let's shift a little bit and come back to the person. And I'm thinking of myself growing up. I'm 8 years old. I get the atlas from my uncle for Christmas. The whole family got an atlas. And it turned out to be, over the years, I think, that my favorite book, the book I look to all the time in terms of
wanting to know more, wanting to see what was out there, right? Understanding in some ways understanding the globe and understanding the world around me through place names and through borders and lines and geometries. And so using the atlas in that way, for me, formulated and informed my geographical imagination. It was fueled by, I think, a desire to see the world and explore, but it also helped form it in some ways. And I think cartography and the map specifically is very much a part and very central in how we understand and interpret the world. And I'd like to go back our final comments from Veronica Della Dora, where she tells us a little bit more about that, about the cartographic imagination.
I would say that the geographic imagination is fundamental in shaping our knowledge of the world. You can't really separate the two. Our geographical imagination is deeply connected to visual images, and when it comes to worldviews, I would say that maps are especially important. Because we do take them for granted, because we trust them, maps end up shaping our visions of the world, and also, I'd say, our place in the world. Abraham Ortelius, a 16th century Flemish cartographer, so also the inventor of the first printed atlas, said that maps are like glasses placed before our eyes. In other words, they're a bit like telescopes, or if you want, magic crystal spheres that bring the world right in front of us, that bring distant places into our room, that make visible what is otherwise invisible to our eyes. At the same time, however, maps are in turn shaped by the geographical imagination of their makers, that is, by their own worldviews. However, maps, for example, are centered on the Greenwich Meridian. They are oriented with north at the top. Many of them use the Mercator projection, which, among other things, has the effect of shrinking Africa and South America. So these maps got us used to the idea that Europe is at the center of the world, or kind of. But if you take a medieval world map, you'll find that it is centered on Jerusalem, the holy city, and it is almost always oriented with east at the top, where terrestrial paradise was supposed to be. Or if you take an Islamic map from the same period, you'll find that it's centered on Mecca and it is oriented with south at the top. So Europe is just cast underneath to the periphery. Now, none of these maps is right or wrong. They're all human constructions. They're all constructions of their time and their culture. They all express a specific worldview, and yet at the same time, they all help construct worldviews and shape geographical imaginations.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, your tour guide into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show or to hear all the archived episodes online, go to www.geographicalimaginations.org. The music you've been listening to tonight comes from Mike Allen and Driftfield Beats. Check him out at his website at www.mikeallenmusic.com. .co.uk. Now let's go back to Doreen Massey and ask her about how that geographical imagination is formed.
Let me give another example. There's a debate which has gone on for decades now within aid organizations. Mm-hmm. Charities which organize aid or which work with people, say, in the global south to work against poverty and sickness and so forth. There's a huge debate about what kind of publicity they should use in order to raise money. There is that kind of publicity which we all know well, which is incredible pictures of suffering children with huge eyes asking for help.
Right.
And on the other hand, there are pictures of people struggling in the fields and in the workshops to do their best, but up against overwhelming forces. Now, those are two completely different imaginations of places in the global south. And the first one, of the suffering, begging children, and this is very difficult for aid agencies, can often actually work better in terms of raising money because people's hearts are drawn. On the other hand, it gives an image of people in the global south as almost at our mercy, as desperate for our help. And us, it puts us in the position of the generous, whereas often it's our own countries that are in part causing the problems that those countries have in the first place. It kind of underlines a relationship of the great white first world aid giver and the suffering supplicant in the global south. If, on the other hand, you present pictures of people working in the fields and up against terrible odds and just asking for a greater degree of equality, you come to a completely different kind of set of thoughts and questions and of policies. It might, for instance, make you wonder about the causes of that disadvantage and to tackle those causes. So you might end up joining a campaign against the current form of globalization. Or you might concentrate on giving people not simply aid, but developing the means to do things for themselves. So the imagination that you work with can influence the analysis that you come to and the actions that you take. And that is really fundamental. And one thing I would stress about that last example is that it's about respect.
Right.
Of not putting people in the position of supplicant. But putting people, in a sense, on an equal par with ourselves, but who are in these terrible circumstances. And I think a lot of what I would like to argue about geographical imagination is that if we get it right, and that, of course, is my position, but if we have a really active and full geographical imagination, then it is about respect for other people. Can I give another example?
Of course, please. Please do, yes.
Often when we're talking, I mean, it's because we're talking about relations between the global north, the so-called developed world, and the south. We often talk about poor countries as being behind us, as being developing rather than developed. And that brings up a whole imagery of countries almost as placed in a historical queue, with maybe, you know, Japan and the USA and Germany at the head of the queue, and Mali, Mozambique, Honduras at the bottom of the queue, at the end of the queue. And so, in a sense, we've turned the whole of world geography into a single historical queue. And people will say, so don't worry about their poverty. They will catch up. Now, I think, first of all, that's hugely problematical because it's implying that there's only one way to be developed. Mali is going to be developed to be like the United States. First of all, it might not want to. And secondly, of course, there is no chance of it doing so while we have the current kinds of globalization that we've got. This is a geographical imagination that kind of tells us there's no alternative. All you can do is strive to be like the countries at the head of the queue. And it's also a way of saying these people are not different from us and living in the same time, they're almost in the past. These people represent what we used to be. And that, too, is demeaning. It is to show disrespect. It is not to recognize that they are different, but equally present in the current world. They are not behind or developing. They are here and now. And in that sense, again, I think geography, a real recognition that what space is about, and space is the centerpiece of geography in many ways. What space is about is the fact that lots of us live at exactly the same moment. It's about our coexistence in exactly the same moment. If time is about things happening one after the other, then space is about things happening at the same time. And that recognition that we are all here together at this moment on this planet poses, I think, the very fundamental question of first, respect, and secondly, okay then, how are we going to live together? Once we've got that, then I think we can start posing very serious questions.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, your tour guide into the geographies of everything and nothing. You've been listening to Episode 1, Keyword, Geographical Imagination. For more information about the show, check us out at the web, www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to the episode. So we're back here at the studio. This show has been pre-produced. I think we'll, in the future, we'll probably do a live version. But for now, doing pre-production, putting together the interviews, and piecing together what I call sort of fragments. And in episode one here, it's definitely about fragments, listening to a few different voices about what the geographical imagination is. I also wanted to lay the groundwork for this program, and lay the groundwork, I mean lay the foundation, talk about what it is we want to do and what it is where it is we're going to go. I'd like to take, I guess, a few minutes and discuss a little bit just that, where are we going to head from here? So we've discussed the geographical imagination the next few episodes, and I have a few already thinking about how to go through maybe the next dozen episodes with a number of different ideas. And I guess I want to be a little concrete about it and not just be sort of talking about the geographical imagination as something that's sort of out there. And in my way of doing that, I think, is to really, and use this metaphor of mapping, but map out, in my mind, with dots, and sort of these fragments, if we can picture each show as a fragment of something larger. In fact, that's kind of how I'm thinking about this. They include projects that I've been interested in the past, but didn't pursue in the depth maybe sometimes that's required of academic research. And so I see these as very much potential radio essays, essays, written essays as well, but radio essays that that will piece together ways of thinking, I think, about space, about the world, about these themes. And the range is quite large. I think that's the bonus of doing an essay program. The essay itself allows for such range of bringing disparate pieces together, bringing fragments together, and hopefully looking at them in new light. Today's was more of a fragment of voices, fragmented voices, but yet they're really talking about very similar things. And the show as a whole, like I said, I think is going to bring together, at least that's the goal, of bringing together a larger kind of picture, a larger map, let's say, with various towns and cities, various themes and questions dotted along this map. I hope it's a mental map that people, listeners, if indeed there are any listeners out there, listeners who are interested in thinking about how we think about the world and how we learn about the world and how that's affected by the world around us and how that is affected and produced by ourselves as well. And it's at that contact point, I think, between those, or the flows between the personal mental map and this collective or community or national or larger kind of humanity, mental map of the world. I like certain themes, and I am not afraid to say I love the word trajectory. I like to think of things as labyrinths, and especially in terms of
how we think about, say, a story, or how we think about even posing a question, whether that's in a classroom. I teach geography, and I like to pose essential questions and then come back to them, very much like some theorists for pedagogy have proposed, that we pose these larger questions and then do the work, much like in a labyrinth. We see the end goal in the middle, but then we're tossed back out to do the work to get back there. And so it's these smaller questions that we need to answer and explore before we can answer the big one. And so I think that's what we're at. We've theorized a little bit what this geographical imagination is, and we're just going to go back out with energy, I think, back into the labyrinth and pick out different scenarios, pick out different themes and questions that will help us, I think, get back to the middle again, or say, so asking different questions about maps, asking different questions about how we see the world, and how we interpret the world around us, I think will all help us get back to that middle of this labyrinth, of this question of, you know, how is it that we see the world and how is that sort of produced? And so our geographical imagination, while Doreen Massey talks about maybe a fuller geographical imagination, how do we get there? And so
this is the expedition we're going to go on with this show, and I'm excited about all the possible collaborations and geographies left to be produced. After all maps have not yet been made. The ideas in progress, like I mentioned earlier, include, and for our next episode, the world through a peephole, panoramic representations of place, especially in the sort of the mid-19th century. Other possible episodes that are in development, I would say, are Sacred Mountains, and we have one here locally in Untersberg, in Salzburg. Another possibility is to look a little bit at medieval cartography, but also on the other side, sort of more, the more creative geographies or creative approaches to ways of knowing space. I want to engage with artists, kind of exploring our conceptualizations of space and how space is produced and reproduced. And so we will be in conversation with artists throughout this program. Other possibilities for programs include the geographies of Africanized honeybees, how cities have rhythm. Placemaking is key to, I think, this show and how we talk about how places are made and remade. And then also the psychogeographical practices of walking and hiking. All of these combined, I think, are going to give us an interesting insight, or at least we hope so, as part of our expedition, if you will, an interesting insight into how we interpret space and how we are part of producing space as people in the world, as humans in the world. Just a couple side notes about the production of the show. We're doing pre-production for now, probably incorporate live interviews at some point, but for now, putting together the pieces here in the studio and playing it online, playing it over the air, broadcasting it, and be archiving it over internet for people to listen to, especially people outside the Salzburg area or people who just can't listen to it at that one time. We're carrying with us a little bit of a do-it-yourself philosophy in terms of production. I mean, I didn't know how to use any of the software about a month ago, so I'm learning as I go, as you could probably tell a little bit, some choppiness to this first episode, but looking forward to cleaning that up as we go and really kind of getting better at the production side, the technical side of the production. So we've reached the end of episode one, keyword geographical imagination, and I want to thank our collaborators from the Open University in the UK, Professor Emeritus of Geography, Doreen Massey, and from Royal Holloway University of London, Professor of Geography, Dr. Veronica Della Dora, and from the University of Kansas in the United States, Dr. Jesse Gilley. Thanks for helping us frame the episode and hopefully, I think, frame the show in general. And as we move forward, we'll refer back to your comments here tonight. I'd like to thank also Radio Fabrique for being open to this concept, this idea of bringing geography to the radio waves and bringing public geographies over the air. And so thank you to them. We'll be here on their radio, on Radio Fabrique, the fourth Saturdays of every month. And you can listen to us directly if you're in the region, or check us out via their live stream from their website at www.radiofabrique.at. Also, I'll archive and post all the episodes on our website, www.geographicalimaginations.org. Look under the tab Episodes for archived material, and you'll be able to listen to it as like a podcast. Also, check out the blog and leave comments about the show. We are looking forward to making this a public sort of geography project and incorporating and listening to and responding to a lot of different voices in terms of the content and what we're talking about here on the show. Next month is episode two. We're calling it Peephole Geographies. In the first segment, we talk with the Salzburg Museum and look at how the Salzburg panorama and Cosmorama paintings inform the way people not only thought about Salzburg, but the rest of the world. And in the second segment, we look at pinhole photography techniques and speak with artist and photographer Patrick Schaudy. So without anything else to say tonight, I look forward to our encounter next month. Ciao, que les vaya bien.